Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, deforestation, soil health, and biodiversity are all major concerns in agriculture. A recent United Nations report claims that an estimated 80% of global deforestation is caused by agricultural practices, and they're also the leading cause of habitat destruction. But does farming always have to lead to deforestation? Can crops and trees actually coexist and even thrive together? Well, the emerging field of mycoforestry is a means of managing forest communities through the introduction of fungi. In this episode, we're looking at a new study which suggests that edible fungi could be used with potentially huge consequences for the future of sustainable agriculture. So, what did the study find? What could it mean for deforestation? And how can all of this benefit the food industry? With me to discuss this is the author of the study, Professor Paul Thomas, Honorary Professor at the University of Stirling's Department of Biological and Environmental Sciences. Hello, Paul, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Stefan. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we take a closer look at your study, I'd just like to understand, let's get the critical issue out of the way first. Is it fungi or fungi?
I think as one of my old professors when I was at uni said, any way you want, really, just say it with confidence.
So hey, I like that.
I've always followed that. Yeah,
That's good advice for life, really, isn't it? Now, okay, let's try and understand how mushrooms that we eat, how are they currently produced? How and where are they normally grown?
Yeah, so the bulk of the mushrooms we consume in the UK are that we see on supermarket shelves are those white button mushrooms that everyone's familiar with. They're normally grown, almost exclusively grown indoors in climate-controlled environments. And interestingly, actually, they use an incredible, I think it's 100,000 metres cubed of peat every year, which, of course, is an unsustainable resource. And we're releasing a lot of carbon by extracting that from the ground. But yeah, that's largely how they're grown, in the dark, indoors, climate-controlled.
When you say climate control, does that indicate a fair amount of energy use? I mean, they're in the dark, I guess. That's one thing that doesn't need energy. But when you control that climate, is it a big impact on energy use?
Actually, the energy use isn't too high, so they don't require too high a temperature. They need, obviously, humidity and moisture. There's a pasteurisation of the media, so there's an energy input there. But also these are grown in, you know, indoors. So when you look at a mushroom growing site, they're buildings, they're big warehouses, they're not greenfield sites.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a little bit of some of the pros and cons of the traditional methods of growing mushrooms.
Yeah, so the pros really are, one, they're reliable. There's no season there. You can grow them year round. They're very easy to pick because they're there growing indoors. So yeah, so they're easy and consistent. The downsides are, as I've mentioned, you know, they use a lot of peat. Some of the more exotic cultivated mushrooms, they rely on single-use plastics. And there is an energy input, you know, there's a decent energy input into these systems. So they use carbon in their production.
Yeah. Okay, now the focus of your study included practices of mycoforestry. Tell us a bit more. How would you describe mycoforestry? How does it differ from traditional forestry methods?
To call it mycoforestry, what you're doing essentially is incorporating fungi or the mycelium of fungus or the spores. So you're incorporating that into your forestry activities. Largely in this case, actually, we use mycoforestry in terms of food production. So we're adding the fungus to the trees and planting the trees to produce food. And this is actually, it's been going on a number of decades. So truffle cultivation, people will know about truffles. That's been going on since the 70s. And really that is a form of mycoforestry, albeit in sort of more orchard-like systems. So it's a process which is already happening.
And you know, whenever I go mushroom picking, then you're looking for forests, really, aren't you? So, I mean, it sounds like an ideal place. Why is that? What is it that the trees offer to mushrooms or fungi generally?
Yeah, so when we look at this group of mushrooms, so the group of fungi you'll be collecting around the base of trees, they're what we call ectomycorrhizal, and they associate with the root system of the tree. And in doing so, they attach to the root, they send fine threads in between the cells of that root tip, and that creates a large surface area between the tree and the fungus, and it's for the exchange of resources. So what the tree does, it collects sugars through photosynthesizing, sends them down into the roots, and it feeds the fungus with those. And in return, the fungus provides the tree with more nutrition than it could normally extract from the ground on its own, and also water. So there's this exchange of resources. And most of the really exciting mushrooms that when you're out foraging, things like chanterelles, boletus, they all grow in this kind of way. So they're all ectomycorrhizal fungi.
So it's not a parasitic relationship. There's a sort of codependency.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what we call mutualistic. So yeah, symbiotic, but that's kind of oversimplifies it really. I think in some cases there is one partner's benefiting slightly more from the association, but largely we would view it as, yeah, mutualistic. They're helping each other.
Yeah. Now you're talking to us from a Scottish island currently. Many mushrooms about? We're talking in May, middle of May now. Can you find anything around there?
Oh yeah. So actually, there's not much, although I did have wild mushrooms yesterday. So I had a different species yesterday, a saprotrophic mushroom, which grows in decaying wood. And we've done a study on that previously, actually. It's very good for skin cancer and skin conditions. But so we had that yesterday. But a lot of the ectomycorrhizal ones, they'll probably be starting towards the end of the month, which is really quite early, and into June. So we're not quite there, really, for that season.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about mycoforestry. And in general, as a field, why is it gaining a bit more attention now?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, actually. So I've been part of a group, really, of scientists who have been working on this for a long period of time. So there's some great scientists. I've got Yamada over in Japan is doing some great work. There's Jesus Perez Moreno over in Mexico, and Alexis Gunnarin down in New Zealand. And these guys have all been working, their research groups have been working on edible mycorrhiza for a number of years. But it's really quite small, you know, it's a very small niche field. And the advances are slow, you know, they're happening slowly, although there have been some nice breakthroughs. But I think really at the moment, there just seems to be this shift in popular culture, like people are getting more interested in it, especially with Susan Simard's work and the, you know, all the noise around root connection and trees talking to each other. So it seems to have really captured the public's imagination. And of course, we've just published a decent paper on this, and we published one last year as well, which is really sort of bringing it more into sort of popular knowledge, really, and trying to bring in more researchers to this field. So I think it's just a combination of things, slow advancement, and also a change in what the public are interested in.
So tell us a bit about your study. What were you investigating? What questions did you pose? And how did you go about the investigating it?
Yeah, so a number of years ago, actually, this study was born from a slightly smaller one that preceded it, where I was working with a friend in Mexico. And out there and in the neotropics, in the Amazon basin, for example, 79% of all the deforestation that's happened there has happened for food production. So the trees have felled to produce food. So we were looking at ways that we could trigger reforestation and how we could perhaps use mycological knowledge and what I work on in a way to do that and what that would look like. So we focused on this blue mushroom out there and we looked at how we could do that. So we published a paper on exactly how to do that, how you cultivate this mushroom, inoculate it into tree roots and then plant it into the ground and how it would look. And we discovered that if we did that, you'd produce more protein per hectare than you would from the most common cause of deforestation out there, which is extensive beef production. So it's incredible. So you can reforest these areas, produce more food, and at the same time have the ecosystem and biodiversity gains from that. So then that was already cool. So then I thought, what about in a broader sense? You know, could we do that in the UK? How would it look? What are the benefits? And what would it look like in terms of carbon sequestration? You know, how would this sit in terms of carbon neutrality? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? So then we started to look at it in quite a bit more detail.
And how did you go about that?
Yeah, so what we did actually, there was a couple of brilliant studies where they've assessed carbon flux estimates for different woodland systems. So we combined that data with some early production data for mycorrhizal species, so how much they produce per hectare, with nutritional metrics, and we put it all together. So we had around about 1.4 million data points globally to look at this kind of carbon flux. Mm-hmm. And then, did the maths, really. And what we found was, we compared it to all our major food groups, all our food production groups, they all emit carbon in their production. And even our most efficient group, which is the production of pulses, still emits carbon. So beef production, for example, can emit up to an incredible 640 kilograms of carbon for every kilogram of protein it produces. And our most efficient system still releases 4 kilograms of carbon for each kilogram of protein produced. And then we compared it to mycorrhiza, so growing these mycorrhizal fungi. And those in their most efficient form can lock down, can sequester 858 kilos of carbon for each kilogram of protein produced.
Blimey.
So it's incredible. So it's really carbon negative food. It's important to say we compare this across all different habitat types. Hmm. And in some habitat types, it's less efficient. It's not as good. But the most efficient is around about 850 kilos, which is incredible.
That's not just incredible. That's insane. I could never have even imagined that. Okay, so this is big news. What are the implications of these findings for agriculture? I mean, how does it impact things like sustainability, deforestation, and soil health?
Yeah, so at the moment, we're still losing 4.7 million hectares a year of forest for food production. Hmm. And this is actually quite a perverse problem, and it's quite a confusing one, because the more trees we lose, the more instability we've got in our climate, which risks our current agricultural production, which means we need more land to grow more crops, you know, for that food production stability. So it's this really confusing negative feedback loop where we've got to fell more trees just to sustain agricultural production. But if we can reforest and turn that into food production with the trees, then we tickle those boxes. We're stemming that deforestation. We're helping with rainfall patterns globally, where we've got all the ecosystem and biodiversity benefits, greater food stability, rural socioeconomic development. It ticks so many boxes. And we also looked in this study, we looked at what would happen if the forestry activities of the top five tree planting countries, if for the past 5 years, what would happen if all those trees had been inoculated with these fungi, how much food production would be produced?
Yeah.
And how many people that would that support? And that produced some really interesting numbers as well.
Yeah. Now, I guess my instant thought is this is predicated, the potential benefits are predicated on a huge increase in consumption of fungi. Mm-hmm. And there are some cultures that don't eat fungi. Is there a demand, I guess, is what I'm saying, because the reason deforestation happens is often economics. You know, it's people that want to make a buck from planting something that will produce more than the trees. Mm-hmm. Can an increased consumption of fungi counter that? What are the potentials for it?
Yeah, actually, the potentials are huge. So we've looked at this just recently. I've been crunching the numbers on it. I don't have the full figures to hand, but the scale of production, if all our forestry in the UK, for example, was planted with these kind of mushrooms on the roots, we'd still be just scratching the surface of the demand globally for these kind of mushrooms. And the other thing I should mention is it's not just the fresh produce. So you can dry these mushrooms, you can process them. So the key species we looked at in this study has a protein content on a dry weight basis of, I think it's around about 19%, 18, 90%. So it's pretty decent, you know, just as a protein source. So you can extract the protein from that. The other thing is the UK is a relatively mycophobic nation. And a lot of the other countries in the world are more voracious consumers and more accepting of novel species.
It's interesting because you go to go to most supermarkets. There are five or six different types of mushrooms there, but it's not vast. But you reckon that the demand is there, just possibly not domestically.
Yeah, absolutely. I think even domestically. So there's different markets for mushrooms, and these ones that we're talking about actually fall into the gourmet range. So they're the ones which are quite highly appreciated. In fact, the Latin name for this species we focused on, the second part of the name is deliciosa. So that gives you an insight as to how tasty these things are. So they're highly appreciated.
Yeah.
And the actual market for that in the UK and Europe is constrained by supply, because there's only so much which is taken out of woodlands those supply channels exist. So there's actually a very big market there that we can definitely tap into for fresh mushroom production.
There's cash to be made. Mm. Now just give us, can you give us a very, very brief microbiology lesson on mushrooms? So they don't photosynthesize in the way that a tree would, presumably. They are under the tree canopy. How does a mushroom grow?
Yeah, absolutely. So mushrooms fall into different categories. There's parasitic, as you've mentioned previously. There's saprotrophic, which are the mushrooms we get in the supermarket. They live off decaying plant matter. And the one we're focusing on here are mycorrhizal. And they can't photosynthesize. So they get their sugars from the tree. So the tree does the job for them. It collects photosynthates, which are the sugars in the leaves, sends them down the stem, into the root system, and into the mushroom. And the mushrooms, it has a thing called mycelium. So the bulk of the mushroom fungus are these very fine threads in the soil, much finer than the tree roots. And that means they can access a much greater area than the tree can on its own, access more nutrients, more resources, and more water even, and provide that to the tree. So there's a bi-directional flow of resources.
Yeah. So are there economic benefits associated with incorporating microforestry practices into traditional agricultural systems? You must have crunched the numbers on this. If you rewild, and it takes a little bit of time to do that, but if you can, how does agriculture benefit from this?
Yeah, absolutely. So we looked at different production figures for different trials, and the trials suggest somewhere between the production levels per year on a hectare, which is about 2.5 acres, they produce anywhere from about 1,000 kilos to 3,000 kilos a hectare.
Wow.
We did all our sums on the lower end, 1,000 kilos. And compared to traditional agriculture, that's relatively low. But of course, you've got all these other associated benefits with it.
Yeah.
This species typically sells for about £10 a kilo. So you're looking at about £1,000 a hectare per year, which isn't much. But when you compare it to traditional forestry, it's more value than you'd get from the wood, for example.
Yeah.
And as soon as you scale that up into thousands of hectares, that's when it starts to get really interesting.
And if we roll back from the stats, can you just describe for me, as a layperson, what it might look like? Are we talking a traditional forest with a layer of mushrooms? Does it need to be farmed? Are there intensive practices that are required? What does it look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's different ways of approaching this, and we've analysed the different systems. And of course, for these systems to take off on a big scale, it has to be economically driven. It pretty much always has to be economically driven. So those kind of systems, you're probably looking at very similar to commercial forestry we see today, but with mushrooms growing under the trees and probably a little bit less dense. So probably less trees per hectare, but mushrooms growing under the base there. That's if you're focusing on production. Of course, if you've got other interests in mind, such as biodiversity and conservational benefits, there's ways we can incorporate the system and tick those boxes as well. So there, and that would look very different. Then you'd have a mixed stand, have mixed species within there, mushroom production, but also more animal and plant life within there. So there's different ways to do this.
Yeah. And presumably, now I don't know the details about this at all, but there are benefits, that there are payments that you can get for reforestation, for setting aside land for this. And so between that, are you allowed to do that and cultivate mushrooms as well and earn the money from both?
Yeah, you absolutely are. So currently, mushrooms are harvested, as a secondary crop in commercial woodlands, and there's no restrictions there. For commercial woodland grants, you normally have to plant at a set density, and that's fine. One thing we really need to work on here, though, is to make this as cheap as possible.
Yeah.
Currently, it relies on lab techniques. So we have to culture the fungus up in the lab under sterile conditions, then introduce it to the root system of the tree, making sure everything's happy and healthy, and then get them planted out. But what we really, really want to do and what we really need to focus on is making this cost just pence per tree, making it highly scalable so it can be rolled out very broadly.
And do you foresee that it could get to the stage where, the phrase is going to be wrong, but these mushrooms self-seed? I mean, I know they don't have seeds, they have spores, but do they self-spore so that once you've introduced them, they're regenerative? Or do you need to impregnate tree roots again and again?
It's a really good point. And I should have mentioned this right at the start. Once we've got the fungus growing on the root system and the conditions are right, it's an annual crop. So the system tends to sit there. There'll be some flux in what species are there. But if we get the species we want to dominate, it will produce annually and for a good few decades. Yeah, so it's a one treatment approach. You treat the trees, plant them, and then there's a little bit of work to do to make sure the management is correct. And then they'll produce annually. Yeah, it's quite an easy system from that point of view.
Paul, this it just seems too damn positive. It's too exciting for me. There must be some challenges involved. I accept it's very, very exciting and you've done some brilliant work. But there must be some challenges associated with cultivating an edible fungi in this way.
Oh, absolutely. So the biggest challenge at the moment is to make this cheap and scalable. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. Number two is to widen the technology so we can bring in more species, so we can do this in a wider range of environments. But also it's dependent on humans picking the mushrooms. It's manpower. It can't really be mechanized. And that's good and bad. That's bad from a logistics point of view, but it's also good in terms of creating jobs in rural areas and rural socioeconomic development. And then there's also, for sure, there's pests and diseases of these things. There's insects which will eat them, and there'll be lots of things we have to learn as we go along, lots of challenges, and we're right at the very start, but it's super exciting.
Yeah. Do many animals eat fungi, sort of woodland animals?
Yeah, they absolutely do, yeah. So depending on the species of mushrooms, some mushrooms are largely left alone. Things like chanterelles are pretty much largely left alone, whereas puccini will be voraciously eaten by deer and other animals.
By me, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Highly favoured. So yeah, it depends on the species of mushroom. And probably one of the biggest issues really are flies laying their eggs within the mushroom. And that can be handled by picking them quite young and other ways through.
Yeah. So you must have thought about this. What needs to be done to capitalise on the findings of your study? What do you hope will happen next?
Yeah, absolutely. So we really need more people. We need more researchers working on this. We need more bodies on the ground, more people pushing this to make it a reality. And it's important to mention as well, we don't really have any funding for this at the moment. So we've applied for funding to take it to the next stage, and we'll find out next month. Hopefully that will be successful.
Good luck with that.
But if not... Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, hope we get it. But if not, then ideally we need, you know, research bodies and funding agencies to fund these kind of projects and let them run, because that's the only way we can do it. We estimate we probably need about another 2 years of quite intensive R&D, and that's the number of trials, and then we'll be able to roll it out on a bigger scale.
Yeah, are those planned?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've done very detailed plans on that. So yeah, as long as we can get the funding to do that, that's absolutely going to happen, and hopefully happen from September. So,
yeah. Now, this podcast is very much a food industry podcast. We have lots of people who work in big food companies and in R&D. What would you like to say to them about what you've discovered? Let's not forget, these people need to make a buck as well.
So there is an economic argument. So I've been researching that recently. And I think definitely if it's something anyone in the industry is interested in from an R&D point of view, which will ultimately lead to obviously financial gains for whatever company is involved, then please do get in contact, because we've got this one application in. And if that's not successful, then there's alternative ways of funding these things. So we'd be very happy to hear from anyone who's interested in this. Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you think the future holds for all of this? In your ideal scenario, what picture the scene that you would like to see unfold?
Oh, I'd love to see lots of the trees which are currently being planted being inoculated with edible mushrooms. And also, I'd like to see it as a driver to increase afforestation. So I'd like to see this as an economic driver for people to plant more trees. And it solves that food, farming, land use conflict. In the UK, we have these diametrically opposed priorities of planting more trees and also producing more food. And we're limited by the amount of land we've got, so we can't do both. So I'd love to see this as a mechanism that we can plant more trees and produce more food on the same parcel of land.
Yeah.
So that's the hope.
Excellent. Well, you know, my mention that the industry's got to make a buck is also tempered by the fact that sustainability is a massive issue in the industry, and a lot of people are doing a lot of work for it. So I wish you the best of luck, especially with your grant application and with carrying on your research here. And gosh, I hope that some of those mushrooms can come my way. So all the best for the rest of your work. And it'd be great to catch up with you again to find out how it's going over the next year or so.
Perfect. Thank you, Stefan. Good to speak to you.
Lovely to speak to you. Professor Paul Thomas, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.